This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Before we get started today, I wanted to share some news with everyone about All In. This talk show has been a great way to connect with folks all across the state, and our small team has enjoyed every minute of it. Unfortunately, All In will air its final show on April 1st, 2022. That's coming up in a couple weeks. It's not an April Fool's joke. It just happens to be the date. We believe in full transparency, so I wanted to let you know that the show was being canceled. It was a decision made by the board of directors at Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations, and what we've been told is that it was made for financial reasons. It's been a pleasure to serve the community with this program, and with the few weeks we have left, please don't hesitate to reach out if there are topics you'd like us to cover before we're out the door. Thank you so much for being a wonderful audience, and as always, you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. In the meantime, since we're still here, it's time to get back to business and talk about the issues. Today, we're joined by public media reporters from around the state to talk about the latest Indiana news and learn about some of the legislation they're keeping up with. We're joined now by Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Welcome back, Brandon.
Thanks, as always, for having me on.
You've been following a lot of bills at the State House. Can you tell us what is the latest that's happening with vaccine mandates?
Yeah, so the House Republicans made their top priority this session, was making it harder for private businesses to enforce COVID-19 vaccine mandates. They were responding to anger from some constituents and complaints about being suspended or even without pay or even fired if they refused to get the vaccine, particularly, it should be noted, from healthcare workers. So the House Republicans relatively easily passed a bill that would, as I said, effectively make it impossible for private businesses to enforce COVID-19 vaccine mandates. Because what they did was they said, if you request a medical exemption and have a note from a healthcare provider, the company has to grant the exception, no questions asked. It also said, if you request a religious exemption to getting the COVID-19 vaccine, and there's no paperwork or anything, it literally, you say, this goes against my beliefs, the company has to grant that exception, no questions asked. So a mandate that can't be enforced isn't really a mandate. So the House passed that relatively easily along party lines. Then it got to the Senate, and the process has not been so easy. The Senate really gutted a lot of the bill, quite frankly. Where it sits right now in the Senate is that the Senate just reverted basically the bill to what I would call the status quo, which it says, yes, if you have a note from a healthcare provider that says you shouldn't get this vaccine, we will, you know, companies have to honor that. But as far as the religious exemption goes, it says if you request a religious exemption to getting the vaccine, a company simply has to follow current federal law in deciding whether or not to grant you that exemption. It also allowed companies to expand testing a little bit beyond what the bill originally called for of employees who don't get the vaccine and other minor things. Well, not minor things, but other things like that. But that was the biggest change in the Senate. And now we're going to see whether the House and Senate can come to an ultimate agreement on what the final product should look like over the next couple of weeks.
Another bill you've talked about previously with us is the handgun permit bill. Have there been any updates with that?
just a small one. So the House easily passed legislation that was very simple. It said you no longer have to get a permit to carry a handgun in public in Indiana. This is something that House Republicans have been pushing for years. The Senate has long been reticent to do that, and this year seems to have shifted a little bit. But last week we saw an 8-hour hearing on that bill, in which we mostly heard what we've been hearing all along, which is proponents say it's a constitutional right that should not be infringed in any way, and that only law-abiding citizens will follow that law anyway, so there's no point to having it. Of course, what people on the other side say is, well, we infringe constitutional rights all the time in reasonable or not ways. And there are thousands of people every single year who apply to the state for a permit to carry a handgun in public and are denied by the state police for one reason or another. They've committed a crime, they have a history of mental health issues, things like that. Then Superintendent of State Police Doug Carter got up to speak and raised a lot of eyebrows. The police have always been opposed to this bill. They say that the permit system is the only easy way for an officer in the field, like in a traffic stop, to check whether the person they've pulled over, the person they're interacting with, has a permit to carry a handgun. So if they have a handgun and they're carrying and they're not on that list, well, that's a problem. Doug Carter went far beyond those criticisms. He criticized Republicans. He said that they were acting not out of the interest of public safety, but in the interest of getting reelected. He criticized the supermajorities for stifling debate. He really went at them in prepared remarks. I mean, these are things he had planned and written down. So that opened a lot of eyes. And then at the end of the committee hearing, the committee suddenly gutted the bill, like out of nowhere, to basically get rid of the change in law entirely. Now, Senate Republicans leadership and House Republican leadership have pledged, we're going to revive this bill in another piece of legislation. We're going to go back to the original, get rid of the license to carry permit system, and that will probably end up being passed by the end of session.
Are there any other states that have similar legislation around carrying a handgun without a permit that they're looking at?
Yeah, there are about 21 states, I think, that's what we've heard, 21 states that have gotten rid of the license to carry. One, for instance, Vermont has never had a requirement to carry, a permit requirement to carry in public. And then there are 29 states, as well as the territories, who still have some sort of requirement like that in place.
There's also a bill that would allow some felony offenders to serve their sentences at the Indiana Department of Corrections. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. Back in 2013, the General Assembly had gone through a roughly five-year process of completely rebuilding its criminal code. And one of the key tenets of that process was low-level felons, so nonviolent, usually first-time offenders, they wanted to keep them out of the prison system because recidivism rates were higher when you go to DOC. And they were arguing, well, these are low-level nonviolent offenders. A lot of times they have mental health or substance abuse issues. And so if we keep them out of the prison system and put them in the communities, in community corrections programs, in treatment programs, in their local communities, that will help rehabilitate them better and keep them from reoffending. The problem is that over the last almost 10 years now, the state hasn't followed through with getting treatment options in place in some local communities. Some communities have great options set up. Some do not. And so what we're seeing in those communities is that the local jails are just filling up because you can't move these offenders to prison. So where do they end up if there's no local community corrections programs or treatment options available? Well, they just wind up in the county jail. And sheriffs at the local level who run those jails are very candid and say, we don't have the programs and the facilities that these people need. Like, this is not a good option for us, and it's not a good option for them. So what this legislation would do would say judges in individual cases can decide where's the best place to this offender. Is it in the Department of Correction, which now has, they say anyway, more treatment options available? Or is there a community corrections program? Is there a local treatment option? Well, let's send them there. Is it just the county jail the best place for them to go? Well, let's send them there. But it gives the judges a lot more flexibility to decide what the best place for that offender is.
I want to move on a little bit to some tax stuff. The Indiana House passed a $1 billion tax cut package. What is this aiming to do? And what are the recent updates with this?
What is it aiming to do? Get people reelected? I mean, I guess I'm being a little bit glib, but that's a big part of it, quite frankly. The tax cut package aims to, they say, improve our tax climate when it comes to, well, there's two reasons the House Republicans say they've been pushing this bill. One, it's a mix of business utility and individual income tax cuts. And let's separate those out a little bit because they kind of fall into two categories as to why Republicans are pushing them. The utility and individual income taxes are taxes paid by Hoosiers. So obviously the individual income tax, most Hoosiers pay that. And then the utility taxes are taxes that you see on your utility bill. And so House Republicans are saying if we, in the case of income taxes, reduce those and the utility taxes eliminate those, that's money that's going back into Hoosiers' pockets. And right now, Indiana is undoubtedly flush with cash. We have record levels of budget reserves and surpluses. The business taxes is not about giving money back to Hoosiers so much as it is, they say it's a reduction, it's a variety of reductions in the business personal property tax, which is a tax that businesses pay on their equipment, everything from a computer to a combine harvester or a boiler. And what Republicans say and what businesses say is that, well, this is hurting our ability to compete for companies coming to Indiana, which is, you know, they'll, you know, when a business is deciding where to locate, they take a look at a wide variety of options. And this is one tax that they say makes us less competitive. Now, it should be noted that the Tax Foundation recently ranked Indiana as the best tax climate for businesses in the Midwest and one of the 10 best in the country. So how much is this going to help? Well, I don't know. But that's sort of the driving forces behind this tax cut package. Where it is right now is Senate Republicans have been pretty steadfast that they don't like cutting taxes at all this year because they're a little worried about the economic future and they would rather wait until next session, which is a budget writing session, to take a look at the full picture before making any major decisions. But Governor Holcomb, who used to be on the Senate Republican side, has now joined House Republicans in saying, listen, I've looked at the latest numbers. I think we're in a great position financially speaking, and I think we can both make a significant tax cut this year and make all the spending priorities that I think we need next year. So let's do it. I think it's looking like we will probably end up with some sort of tax cut this session. What exactly tax cut that is, I can't say yet.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Brandon, for the updates, and it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Brandon Smith is a State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking with our team of public media reporters to get updates on the stories they're following. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that number is 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sove. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking with our team of reporters to get updates today on the latest stories they're working on. And with us now is Jeannie Lindsay, education reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Welcome back, Jeannie.
Thanks for having me.
One of the biggest education bills being talked about right now is House Bill 1134. Can you tell us what this bill is about?
Yeah, so lawmakers have pitched this bill as a parent engagement and school transparency bill, and it really has several provisions in it that have to do with parental oversight and authority consent. And then it also talks about which sort of things schools can or cannot talk about along the lines of, you know, discrimination, race, religion. Used to include politics, but that part was taken out in the Senate. So the idea behind this legislation that lawmakers have said is to get parents more involved and aware of what is going on in their classrooms. The bill has changed a lot since it was initially proposed at the start of session, since it passed the House. The Senate has made several changes to it. But a few of the things it touches on, it talks about curriculum review by parents, whether that's through a school board advisory committee or just a request to review content that's provided to schools by teachers. It talks about mental health support in schools and parents' need for consent for schools to provide that to students. It also talks about, you know, different concepts, which is one of the things that has been a particular sticking point, is these concepts that would be banned from being promoted in schools. There used to be 8 concepts that lawmakers say are divisive and have no place in classrooms, but that's been reduced down to 3. Essentially says schools can't promote the idea that a person should be discriminated against or treated preferentially or adversely, or that they have any sort of superiority or inferiority based along the lines of their race, ethnicity, sex, or religion. There's also a part of the bill that says that schools can't promote the idea that anyone bears responsibility for actions done by another person who shares some aspect of their identity. So there are a wide number of things in this bill, but, you know, it also talks about student surveys and, you know, third-party vendors and data. So we'll see what the final version of it looks like, but those are some of the core elements in this legislation to get to a more transparent and parentally engaged education landscape in lawmakers' view.
Now, this bill, I'm going to assume there are people for it and against it. What are folks who are against this bill saying?
Yeah, and there certainly have been a lot of people at the State House who have been opposed to this. And because the bill has had so many forms during this short legislative session, the opposition to it has evolved as the bill has. So at first, there were a lot of concerns about, you know, what it would add to teacher and schools' workloads if they were required to post curriculum materials online. There were also concerns with the banned concepts that it would undermine the teaching of history and societal issues, things like, you know, the George Floyd protests and Black Lives Matter and, you know, some of these really important current events that are happening. And so there were a lot of concerns that this would kind of tie teachers' hands. And there were also provisions at the start that, you know, teachers would have to come up with all of these different materials because parents and students would be opting in and out of content as the bill would have allowed. Now that the posting requirements have sort of been taken out a little bit or reworked quite a bit, as well as those banned concepts, a lot of the concerns now have centered about the mental health support access for students. One of the parts of the bill would require that parents sign off or provide their consent for students to receive ongoing mental health, psychological or social emotional support. And we heard from people in the committee, the committee's bill hearing, that, you know, that could prevent students from even speaking up asking for those services if the parent was the source of, you know, the problem, essentially. So there are concerns about access to those services. The parts with the divisive concepts or the banned concepts also has people wondering, especially, you know, Black Hoosiers and Black Hoosier representing organizations, wondering who this legislation is for, because they see it as something that's really centered around the wants and frustrations of white parents in this moment where a lot of them are talking more about critical race theory, and that's sort of been buzzing around. But, you know, Black Hoosiers and Black parents have said, you know, there are plenty of things that we've been frustrated by for so long. Where's, you know, our legislation? And so there's concern about who this bill is even designed for. And, you know, Hoosiers of color, parents of color say that it's not for them. So that's some of the opposition. Again, it's very wide reaching with a wide reaching bill.
So Jeannie, how are schools and teachers reacting to House Bill 1134?
Yeah, so even with the changes, there's still a lot of opposition. I mean, teachers have been at the State House opposing this bill. They, you know, have plenty of concerns with the origins of the bill. So despite the changes that have been made, there are still plenty of people who have been opposed and remain opposed to it. There have been some schools even across the state who have formally passed resolutions to oppose this legislation. So saying as a school district, as a school corporation, that they remain in opposition to this legislation. So there certainly have been some advocacy organizations who have even ramped up their opposition to it as it's gotten closer or further along into the process. So certainly a lot of opposition from different teachers around the state and different types of schools too, because, you know, requiring that schools post materials online in any form, whether through a management system or otherwise, there are schools that still struggle, especially in rural areas, struggle with connectivity and access to some of those resources in order to meet the parameters of the legislation and what it might say about that.
We have a couple of minutes left here. I want to touch on House Bill 1041. We're going to talk more about it in detail on Wednesday, but can you give us a little overview?
Yeah, so House Bill 1041 would ban transgender girls from participating in girls' school sports. And that legislation has received pushback every step of the way, similarly to House Bill 1134. There have been a lot of concerns come up in committee about what it would do to the mental health of transgender children, and the impact that it would have on girls who are just wanting to play sports with their friends. The original version of the bill would have covered K-12 all the way through higher education, but it was amended almost immediately to only cover K-12. So most of the students that this bill would apply to would be, you know, in those early school levels. The Indiana High School Athletic Association has a policy on the books, and so there's question of whether it's even needed at the high school level. But a lot of organizations, groups, parents, students, LGBTQ Hoosiers have spoken out against this legislation because they see it as doing more harm and in search of a problem. There are really not any examples of, you know, what this bill would address. There was one example that was briefly mentioned, but it was handled at the local level. Not even sure which school that example is pulled from, but the examples that have been used to promote this bill and to you know, try and support it have mostly come from, well, have pretty much all come from outside of Indiana.
And so is it fair to say that this bill just was it a reaction to something? Did it just come out of thin air? I mean, what was the reasoning?
Yeah, there have been other states who have passed similar legislation. There's an organization, a national organization, who's been, you know, working with some of the legislators in other states, and you know, those states who have passed those pieces of legislation, there's been litigation around that. So there's a sort of a national effort by this group to, you know, get more states to propose these bills. In fact, one of the people who testified in committee was a representative from Idaho, who passed this legislation. And so it seems more of a national sort of campaign versus a response to an Indiana issue.
Before we let you go, are there any other stories you're working on that we can keep an eye out?
Honestly, everything is just trying to keep up with session. It has been a fire hose of news with education and schools. And these two bills we talked about today certainly have been getting a lot of attention, but there are other pieces of legislation that have to do with schools and education. And I'm going to be doing my best to talk more a little bit about those as we get closer to the end of things. But yeah, just trying to keep up with it all right now.
Well, thank you so much, Jeannie. We appreciate it. Jeannie Lindsay is an education reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. And now we're going to head over and chat with Justin Hicks, Workforce Development Reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and get some insight into what he's working on. Justin, you've been working on a story, I understand, around low unemployment rates and some of the unexpected consequences. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how the low unemployment rates are looking here in Indiana?
Yeah, of course. So, as you mentioned, we have really low unemployment in Indiana. And I'm looking specifically here at the MSA level, which is the Metropolitan Statistical Area. So, that's defined as an area that has a city with 50,000 or more people. And the area can be a little bit bigger than that because it can draw in, you know, sort of your neighborhood communities all around that city that kind of feed into it. So I was looking at just like MSA's nationally unemployment statistics. Just in the bottom five, and bottom being a good thing, like bottom meaning you have low unemployment. In the bottom five MSAs for unemployment, you have like four of them are all in Indiana. I mean, it's amazing. So Elkhart, Goshen has the lowest in the country right now. Just above that, Bloomington and Columbus each have 1% unemployment. Lafayette, West Lafayette, 1.1% unemployment. So, I mean, you know, and I should say too, Fort Wayne, Indianapolis, all of those areas are not far behind, you know, 1.2, 1.3, that kind of thing. So we do have very, very low unemployment rates in Indiana right now. And of course, we see that playing out in really interesting ways in the labor market. Low unemployment really means it's also a tight labor market, right? So if you are an employer, if you're in a company and you're trying to hire people right now, you are having one heck of a time because you're trying to find people to hire. And most of everyone already has a job if they're looking for a job. So you may have to poach them from a competitor, or you get really creative in how you lure those people, you know, to your company.
Yeah, I think it's always that thing where it's like, I don't know if it's a chicken or egg type of situation where low unemployment rates, it's a good thing, but maybe it's not always a good thing for companies that really need employees.
The metaphor that I was kind of thinking of a little bit earlier today is sort of like lemonade. It's like we have this really like nice, sweet glass of lemonade in front of us. And to be sure, you know, it tastes great, right? It's a great thing. But like, let's also acknowledge that it takes some lemons, right, to make lemonade.
Well, would you say, I mean, for Indiana, like how is this situation impacting our state? Are we seeing a good thing coming out of it? Are people benefiting, or is it hurting?
Yeah, I think by and large, I think this is a good thing. I think people are benefiting from this. Your average worker, right? You and me, we are in positions as workers to bargain a little bit more with our employers and say, listen, if you want me to keep working, you got to pay me a little bit more. You know, the guy down the street is going to pay me X amount of dollars more than you are. So, you got to show up. A lot of employers have talked about how this is playing out. When you see even McDonald's and Wendy's and Burger King kind of, putting $15 an hour on those signs, then other employers are looking around and saying, oh my gosh, if I'm not even paying better than McDonald's right now, I got to get with it. I got to pay better. So it's a good thing for workers in that sense, all across the board. I will say too, low unemployment is also a really, really good time for workers who traditionally have barriers to being hired. So that would mean your workers who maybe have disabilities, cognitive or physical, or maybe workers who have former prison records, or barriers kind of like that makes them harder to be hired. We're seeing those people getting into the workforce right now. They can use that sort of tight labor market leverage to say, you don't have anybody. I'm a good worker. You may have to, adapt a little bit to get me into the workforce. But, if that's what you got to do, that's what you got to do right now because you need me.
And when it comes to the competition for workers here in Indiana, are we seeing that it's a lot harder to get folks versus other states?
Not necessarily. I think this is a problem that, that trying to find workers kind of thing. It's an interesting problem for us in the sense that because we are such a manufacturing heavy economy, we have a lot of jobs that traditionally don't need a ton of education to get into the door, in a lot of these manufacturing facilities. Where employers are having a really hard time, though, is in those jobs where you do need a little bit of education. So, if you want to operate like a CNC machine or any kind of computer assisted designing or manufacturing, sometimes you need at least maybe like a year or two of community college or a specific program to kind of get you into that role. Employers are having a really, really hard time, especially with those roles. And so because of that, employers right now, they're actually thinking a little bit more about automation. And this is traditional economics 101 teaches you that when you have a hard time finding flesh and bone people to do a job, it might be time to start thinking about, getting a robot arm or something like that to do the job, because that robot arm can do the work faster anyways.
You mean a robot arm, not someone putting a robot arm on themselves.
Right. Yes, of course. I'm talking about, you go into like the car factory, right, and you see the robot arm pick up the wheel or whatever, and stick it on the car in the right place. Yes. In the specific example that I saw, there was a tube bending company in Elkhart that for the first time ever was installing this $1.5 million robot arm. And they recognize that that's a big investment, but for them, it just made sense because they couldn't find enough workers. And plus, it was nice for them because they wanted to grow right now. I mean, they're getting more orders than ever. They work with some RV companies and they supply parts. So they're getting more and more orders than ever right now. They're trying to keep up with that demand. So the robot arm can also do things a little bit faster. So automation, in a nutshell, is something that you will see emerging out of a tight labor market.
Is there anything else that folks should keep an eye out when it comes to low unemployment rates?
Yeah, so I talked to some economists for the story that I'm working on, and one of the things that they're watching, the ones that I've talked to said they're not really all that worried yet, but they're watching closely, is what is called the wage price spiral. So back in the Reagan era, we had this situation where as wages went up, the prices for goods went up, right? Inflation went up. So, and then as inflation went up, wages went up because workers said, I got to buy milk and milk costs more money, you know? And so economists that I've talked to have said, wait until the Fed raises interest rates and has time to kind of play around with the economy a little bit before we actually say what's happening. We obviously know that there is some inflation happening. They think that the Feds can maybe tamp it down, but that is something they'll be watching and maybe something we should watch as well. You know, the wage price kind of spiral to infinity. There's a couple other just, you know, very small side effects. You know, if companies can't find workers in Indiana, could they possibly think about moving outside of Indiana to places that have higher unemployment rates to find those workers? It could happen. Again, economists have said it's something to watch, but maybe don't be too worried.
Well, thank you so much, Justin. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. Justin Hicks is a workforce development reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. I'm Miriam Soap. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap. We're speaking with public media reporters around the state today to learn about the latest Indiana news they're covering. Now we're going to take a look at the COVID pandemic here in Indiana and find out what's happening. With us is Lauren Chapman, digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Welcome, Lauren.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it seems like every time we have you, we have to talk COVID. And so let's start with the statewide COVID numbers we're seeing right now. What do those numbers look like?
Oh, you know what? For maybe one of the first times ever, I get to say some good news. All of our metrics are pointed down. So last week, the state only added 4,651 new cases to its total. Hospitalizations are down significantly. Mm-hmm. The state's COVID-19 hospital census is at its lowest since August 1st. And IDOH added 255 new deaths to its total, but those deaths are from a little bit farther back because deaths take longer to report than cases or hospitalizations. So there's a lot of pretty nice, good stuff coming out of our Omicron spike. So it's good news.
Now that we've sort of been through this for about, what is it, almost 2 years now, it seems like there's often a spike and then a decrease. Is this what we're seeing now? Is the decrease just a typical dip that may come back up?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that was really interesting about I'm so sorry for the amount of geeking I'm about to do. But so last fall's Delta spike, that late summer surge that we saw, cases only dipped down like a little bit. So the plateau that we kind of hit right before we saw the winter Delta surge, and then we immediately transitioned into the Omicron surge, cases hadn't dipped back down to the, you know, pandemic lows that we saw in June. Because, you know, we're at the end of winter-ish, currently experiencing the second spring of deception in Indiana, we're likely to continue to see those cases continue to fall. One of the positives and absolutely the negatives of Omicron is that it did spread through our unvaccinated population like wildfire. And so to a certain extent, the blessing to that is that you have a whole bunch of people who have that temporary natural immunity that are suddenly unable to spread COVID-19 as easily as they would be before. Keeping in mind, however, that reinfections, I mean, we're talking more than 60,000 the last time I looked at the dashboard of people who have gotten COVID-19 multiple times. So, yeah, I am loath to make any predictions because that is not my place, but we're definitely seeing a pretty significant decrease in cases. We might end up seeing the kinds of decreases that we saw last summer, where we reported only about 200 new cases per day. But, you know, it's just because of where our state's vaccination rates are and because of the variants that we have seen from COVID-19, it's only a matter of time until we see the next spike. The question is how bad it is versus how many folks we can get fully vaccinated in the interim.
Right, right. And can you remind us what are the case rates right now? How many we're seeing a day?
Yeah, right now. So that's actually a bit of a complicated question to answer, because the Indiana Department of Health made a number of changes to its vaccine dashboard. But based on my math from last week, we're seeing about 800 new cases per day-ish. And that is continuing to drop pretty significantly, which is crazy because last week reported fewer than 5,000 new cases the entire week. And it was just the middle of January that we reported 98,000 new cases in a single week.
Wow. It's kind of wild to think back when the pandemic first began, and it's like you heard one case, two case, and, you know, here and there. And it was like this ominous thing. And now it's like the numbers that are thrown out are astronomical. And it's just like we've become used to it.
Yeah, the context has kind of gotten blown away. I remember reporting on, you know, the first, the second, the fifth deaths. And, you know, we're likely to hit 22,000 confirmed dead, probably tomorrow, maybe Wednesday. And I mean, it's just, it's astronomical. The context is blown all out of the water.
When it comes to masking and mandates here in the state, has any of the messaging changed around masking since COVID cases are looking to be in the decrease right now?
Well, one of the problems that we run into for a change in masking guidance is that the masking guidance that we had before was a strong suggestion at best. And even when we saw the Omicron peak, a lot of counties, because that decision was left up to counties as a result of legislation that the General Assembly passed last year, a lot of counties just didn't bring back their mask mandates or their even strongly worded mask requirements. Marion County never brought back their mask requirement. I believe Monroe County did for a little bit, but so not a whole lot has changed. Even from the recommendations nationally, I think Indiana had already rolled back those particular mitigation efforts a long time ago.
Well, if you're listening and have any questions or comments for our program, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. Again, that number is 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Lauren Chapman, digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and looking at the state's COVID numbers and other things around COVID. Lauren, the Indiana Department of Health recently made changes to its quarantine and contact tracing guidelines for schools. What are those changes?
Just so many changes. So we can start with the more low level that sound a bit scarier before we get to the flip side of that. So the Indiana Department of Health, not last week, but the week before, announced that schools would no longer have to do contact tracing or case reporting to the state. So for a little bit of context, case reporting has been a bit hit or miss the entire pandemic. Schools do not have the staff to try and keep track of everybody. Health departments had stepped in to try and help with that contact tracing. And so the statement that was released by the Indiana Department of Health credited Dr. Box, basically saying that this is burdensome for schools and it's not doing what we think we want it to do. So there's no real reason to keep doing this. And so, I mean, a lot of folks had concerns that the data itself was incomplete, that it wasn't giving an accurate, you know, view of school-based cases. And so that change actually meant that the state's school dashboard is being sunset. So if you go to the state's just generic COVID dashboard, there's a tab for schools. That dashboard is being sunset and being replaced with another dashboard that focuses on Hoosiers ages 0 to 19 to give a better and more holistic view of that, as opposed to trying to explain that, you know, schools are part of a circle, but that circle isn't fully, you know, surrounded by a whole other circle that are still being counted in different databases.
Are these changes something that folks are on board with? Have you heard from anyone who is opposed to this?
Yes and no. The folks that are, you know, who pay attention to the data, who, you know, the epidemiologists, the general data nerds, are kind of are seeing the bigger picture here, that like if you're not getting good data, there's no point in continuing to push for bad data or incomplete data. So that's kind of the big change that folks are seeing. There are a lot of people who are concerned that that particular guidance means that the state is giving up on caring about schools and school-based spread of COVID-19. And I can absolutely understand their perspective, but I think it comes from a more practical place than that.
So in addition to sort of these changes, is there changes in testing and vaccine or masking requirements in schools?
No. Another one of the reasons why they made this particular change and the other change that I completely forgot to talk about, which is the quarantine guidance, is because COVID-19 vaccines have been available for a hot minute for school age kiddos. So all Hoosiers 5 and older can go, can be fully vaccinated against COVID-19. And so that was one of the reasons why IDOH was like, these mitigation efforts aren't necessarily working. And so we might as well just kind of leave that one be. The other big change that I neglected there was ending quarantine guidance. So first, a refresher on terms. To quarantine is when someone has been exposed to COVID-19 but doesn't have symptoms. They're staying home to make sure that they don't develop symptoms and they don't accidentally spread the virus to others. Whereas isolation is when someone has tested positive or they have COVID-19 symptoms and they are isolating at home to make sure they are not actively spreading an active virus to others. And also they're sick, so stay home. Don't feel gross around others. So the change, the new guidance does not affect isolation for students, right? If a student is sick, if a student tests positive for COVID-19, they have to stay home for at least 5 days or until symptoms significantly improve, 24 hours fever-free, and then followed up for another 5 days after symptom onset, wearing a mask in schools. But school-age kids, from including kids in like childcare programs, early learning programs that are run through FFSSA to high school, no longer have to quarantine if they are exposed to somebody with COVID-19 until they start to develop symptoms or until they test positive for COVID-19.
I'm glad you made that distinction between quarantine and isolation, because I think it gets confusing sometimes where we think it's the same thing. Like somebody tests positive and they're like, oh, I'm just going to quarantine and walk around my house with my family and infect them all. whereas isolation is literally you're going to put yourself in another room.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going to lay up on the, you know, lock yourself in your bedroom for a couple of days, get a lot of good sleep and try not to breathe on anyone.
Right. And so with regards to the quarantine changes, though, you know, students are able to come back after a shorter period. Was this in light of what the CDC recommendations were?
Yes. Yeah. Those changes were actually made before the beginning of the spring semester. And those were the recommendations that were made on, I think, like December 27th, even. Those recommendations aligned the Indiana's guidance with the CDC's. And also were a bit confusing based on whether or not a school required masks versus didn't require masks versus exposure, you know, at home versus exposure in school. And so all of that's kind of being thrown away. And so it's no more quarantine guidance, but you do still have to isolate if you test positive or if you develop symptoms of infection.
Have schools seemed to be on board with these changes in guidelines?
You know, honestly, I haven't heard a whole lot either way. I know that a lot of what I have heard has been parents who are concerned because they have kiddos who have underlying health conditions, or they, you know, have somebody with who's immunocompromised in their home, you know, being really concerned about what all of this means for them. But I have to imagine that for a school that's trying to do the business of, you know, educating our kiddos, also having to single-handedly run a contact tracing center and also figure out how to navigate, you know, kids who are being exposed at school, out of school, all of the confusing guidance. I think that this simplification is probably a welcome change for them.
And parents and families, do they seem on board with this?
It's a bit of a mixed bag. I think for the, you know, for the families who are already on board, who, you know, are already, you know, fully bought into all of the mitigation efforts and things like that. You know, I think that that this change isn't going to really affect them too much. And I think that the one thing that I've heard over and over again from families, from epidemiologists, from others, is that the simplification of the guidelines is really, really helpful to them, that it's making things a whole lot easier to understand and just feels like a level playing field, even as it feels like those mitigation efforts are being pulled back.
What does it look like if we look ahead to summer break? Do you think that might change some of these guidelines? Or, I mean, I guess it's hard to predict the future.
I mean, I will say for the last 2 years, we've seen, we have not seen the state of Indiana, with very little exception, reinstate any mitigation efforts, right? It's not like people have, counties or local governments have relaxed mask mandates, or schools have relaxed mask mandates and then reinstated them in response to surges in new cases. So I am hesitant to predict that is suddenly going to change. I'm hopeful that that kind of change does happen. But I think that the state strategy from the beginning of the vaccine rollout has been to hyper-focus on making sure everyone's getting vaccinated. And that was very clear in the guidance that the Indiana Department of Health put out when they were talking about these changes to school reporting requirements, was that they were heavily emphasizing making sure that all Hoosiers 5 and older were getting fully vaccinated as soon as humanly possible. So, yeah, I don't think any of it's coming back. I don't think these mitigation efforts will be resurrected, even if we do see a surge in the near future.
And let's hope there are no more surges.
We could only be so lucky.
It's always right when I'm about to make plans to go on vacation or something. There's a surge. I'm like, I guess we're just going to hang out at home.
Uh-huh, yeah. It's always around the time I'm planning on baseball.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Lauren. Before we let you go, is there anything else you've been covering we should know about?
Yeah, it's all COVID-19 data, but there's been a really crunchy change to the cases data that personally I feel personally victimized by, because instead of the instant gratification of knowing all of the data you could ever want, that's suddenly gone. And this is my official appeal to change things back, even though the current way that they are doing it is way better from like all perspectives, math, epidemiology, basic understanding. It's way better now than it was before.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Lauren. We appreciate it. Lauren Chapman is the digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. If you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks so much for listening. This is All In.